Well, tonight is week two in our series looking at Genesis 12 to 50. As you can see, we aren't looking at every single verse, but we are looking at the key figures and characters of the book. I wonder if you ever got one of those, they don't send them often, one of those letters in the mail that says you are the winner of $1 million. You ever got, they used to send these all the time. You'd open them up and, well, the first time you got them, at least, you'd open them up and think, wow, this is amazing. And, of course, what you'd realise is actually what they might have been offering was more like $500, and there was actually a million other letters sent out and you had to fill something in and give them some of your details, and you suspected they might actually use the details for something else and you probably wouldn't win anything. Nowadays, actually, social media has this. It's called share this link for a $500 gift voucher. Anyone shared the link? Come on. Come on. Someone shared it, right? I must admit, I've shared it. I've shared that link just to see if I might get that gift voucher to Bunnings or to Kmart or to Aldi or whatever else it is. And, of course, lo and behold, you don't get anything. And this is not an uncommon experience, in fact. Someone promises something and then they don't come through. It might be in silly things like that, but it might be in more serious things like friendships. It might be in even more serious things like marriages. It's not unusual for us to encounter moments when people say they'll do something for us, and yet either it comes across actually that they'll only do it if we do something for them, or they just don't even do it. And so free doesn't really come across as free. Free always has strings attached to it. This makes us often quite suspicious of people. It makes us suspicious of generosity. We always think twice when someone offers us something, and we always seem to have a plan B up our sleeve, don't we? The plan B might mean that we'll just expect failure, and so we'll actually not raise our hopes. We might just impute selfish motives on the person who's offered something. In fact, plan B always means that we maintain a certain level of distance with them. And if we don't maintain that distance, if we take them at their word, we're considered naive and slightly ignorant, aren't we? Because free ain't free. That's all well and good. I mean, that's the world we live in. That's the reality of people who we encounter. But that actually is quite dangerous when it comes to our spiritual life and our relationship with God. It makes us, I suspect, suspicious of grace, makes us suspicious of the idea which preachers up here often talk about, that God freely forgives your sin, makes you suspicious, and perhaps it forces us to have a plan B even when it comes to God. That, you know, we kind of believe in grace, but we also feel like, well, if we do a certain level of things, it's just more likely that grace will be ours to receive. A lot of theological thinking, a lot of books have been written about this question. Is grace really free, or is there actually a transaction going on behind all that wordplay, all those discussions? The real question we're asking ourselves is, what basis will God really save his people? This evening we come to what is really one of those uncomfortable Old Testament passages, Sodom and Gomorrah. And for most people who've read it, if you have read this passage before, it's a passage I suspect you associate most closely with the idea of God's judgment. It's one of those really awkward Old Testament passages about judgment. But I want to ask you just to withhold that judgment about the passage. I want to challenge you perhaps to see that there's a bigger question at play in this part of Genesis. That actually the question being asked is, on what basis will the Lord save his people? On what basis will the Lord save his people? Now, our passage opens with a moment of high hospitality. For those of you who still live at home, hospitality is like when you have someone over and you feed them and care for them. Yep. Abraham is in the heat of the day. It's like 45 degrees, 50 degrees in the Middle East, right? And he's in the tent and he sees these three people at a distance. Now, if it's me, I would make myself look busy in the tent, pretend I never saw them. But Abraham does the opposite. He runs out of the tent into the heat, comes to them, falls at their feet, welcomes them in, draws them in. I mean, to cook in that kind of time of the day, well, that's quite a task because it's so hot. But he feeds them. He kills the best animal. He rests them. And all this time, he's unaware of who he's caring for. It's only as we rejoin the meal later that it's revealed that he's not just been caring for three strangers. He's actually been caring for angels. It's such a bizarre little part of Genesis, but I think it's what Peter talks about when in 1 Peter 4 he talks about hospitality. He says, make sure you show hospitality because you never know, you might be offering it to angels. I think he's actually thinking about this account in Genesis. But soon Abraham comes to realize that he's offered hospitality not just to three strangers, not just to angels, but he's actually offered it to the Lord. It's an extraordinary encounter between God and man, between God and his chosen representative. And this little encounter, this little moment, this of meeting is what the writer of Genesis uses as a narrative to explore this bigger question. On what basis, Lord, will you save your people? On what basis will you save? Having finished the meal, Abraham, you'll see in verses 16 where we pick it up, finds himself alone with the Lord on a mountain. Abraham is one of the key figures in the Genesis story. We introduced to him briefly last week, and he is the bearer of the promise, the great covenant of Genesis. The Lord has made all his great promises to Abraham back in Genesis 12. It's referred to again in subsequent chapters, and it's referred to here in verses 18 and 19. And out of this relationship comes the opportunity for Abraham to ask these questions. And all the questions center on this town of Sodom, which they can see in the distance. Now, even as Sodom is introduced in verse 16, there is a real sense of, there's an ominous foreboding about it, that something good is not about to take place. They look down on Sodom at this point. And as they gaze down on it, it becomes apparent to Abraham that nothing good lies in store for this town. But those in Sodom, well, they have no idea of this. My wife and I, Emily and I, we used to love going on long car trips. We can't do that anymore. We have an 8-month-old. She can travel about 10 minutes before cracking it. But we used to travel like out to the country. So we get in the car, we just pack a couple of bags and we do trips from country towns where we had friends, and dearly love the country because I just love those moments when you're on roads and you just see paddock after paddock of just lush green grass and crops and animals. It makes a city sicker like me feel at home, right? But I remember going past a paddock that was just lush with green grass, and all these grass with these fat woolly sheep. On the other side of the road, there was a fairly barren paddock, and there were some sheep there as well. But you really felt like these guys, these sheep, they'd made it in the sheep world. But as you went round the corner, you realised that the building right next to the paddock was an abattoir. And so even though these sheep thought that life was grand, well, they were about to become lamb chops. I think that says something a bit about our attitude to God's judgment and judgment on our life. It says something certainly about the way that the inhabitants of Sodom really approached life. They had no sense of what they were doing and how it had come to the Lord, but the Lord was intimately aware. Sodom was located in the fertile area northeast of the Dead Sea, and these people went about their lives busily unaware, but it had caught their attention. Now, we normally think of Sodom. I mean, if you've heard this story before, or if you've heard the word sodomy, which refers to homosexual sex, you've normally thought of the town of Sodom in relation to homosexuality. But what you come to see as you read through the scriptures is that actually the sin of Sodom is even greater than that. The word actually used to describe their sin here is used in other Old Testament books to describe a myriad of things, like the failure to care for orphans in Exodus 22, or the oppression of servants in Deuteronomy 24. And in Ezekiel 16, this is what Ezekiel says about Sodom. Now, this was the sin of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters were arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and the needy. Sodom was more than just a city that had got its sexual ethics upside down. It was a city that was consumed by her own beauty and self-sufficiency. And it was a city whose leaders didn't care for the poor and the marginalized and the oppressed. It was a city whose leaders cared about wealth and prestige and place. Her failures were total. But what we come to see in this moment of the Lord's reflection on Sodom is that the Lord is not silent when the marginalized and the poor and the oppressed are treated badly. He will not be silent about that. And so the outcry rises against Sodom. With this town in mind, I mean, they're looking at it. The Lord is standing next to Abraham. They're looking down at Sodom. Abraham embarks on what's one of the really amazing theological inquiries. I reckon there's theologians across the world who'd love to have this moment with the Lord to probe him, and Abraham probes him. You'll notice something about his questions. He starts tentatively at first, but then it gets faster, and the intros to his questions get shorter, and the questions become more direct. But consistently throughout all his questions, he's drawing on this premise that there are righteous people in the wicked town of Sodom, and those righteous people deserve to be saved. That's the premise that he has in all his questions. It's kind of like Abraham has developed a formula to understand God's salvation. If this, then this. If righteous people exist, then they will be saved. But isn't it interesting how he ends his questioning with one question left unanswered? He stops short, so to speak. He goes all the way, but he stops at 10. He works from 50 to 45 very tentatively. Then he makes this large, more audacious drop by 10 down to 30, then 20, then 10. And then he stops, and you wonder, why does he stop at that very moment? Why not push the hypothetical one further? I suspect it's because Abraham just cannot presume to even ask that of the Lord. He can't even presume to ask that of the Lord. Now, if you pause the story for a moment and you think about where perhaps this is going, perhaps you think, well, the point of this all is that, well, many get saved because of few. That's not completely wrong. I mean, there's other ways that perhaps could be expressed that covers how God operates. But that's actually not what God is teaching in this passage. God's lesson about his saving work and his saving ways is not over. And so we turn to chapter 19. Now, you might be wondering, why do we read those first two verses in chapter 18? We could have just gone to verse 16. It's because chapter 18 and chapter 19 are parallels. There's a parallel between Abraham and Lot. And so we turn to Lot, who seems to be very much the copy of Abraham, although he's mentioned in 19 and Abraham's mentioned in 18. Lot is hospitable, he's courageous, he's welcoming. He's clearly better than the rest of the people in the town. In contrast, this is a city that's corrupt beyond comprehension. And what takes place in those first 7-8 verses of chapter 19 kind of really just turns the volume up on the level of evil in Sodom. It's soon after the meal, and verse 4, we hear that all of the city, the narrator makes it clear, there's no place to escape when it comes to culpability, when it comes to blame. Every single person in the city is covered by this group, young and old from every end of town, and they ask for the most extraordinarily perverse things, even for an oriental culture like Assyria, where homosexual practice was okay. The idea of homosexual rape is extraordinarily perverse. And in comparison to the city, Lot actually does appear to be the righteous few that Abraham was talking about. Compared to them, he is those righteous few. At this point, we think, oh, I can see what Abraham was asking about in chapter 18. Perhaps he thought about Lot. Perhaps Lot's righteousness might be the salvation of Sodom. But we read on. And we come to see that Abraham's formula starts to break down. It's verse 8 of chapter 19. That's the turning point. That's the hinge, so to speak, in understanding Lot. It's the moment when all your goodwill starts to flow out the door for Lot, because he seems to have had a complete brain explosion. His failure starts to compound. Lot has just offered his two daughters up to this crowd. At this moment, his eagerness to kind of fulfill his hospitable obligations has blinded him to his greater priority to his daughters. And then, if that's not enough, when he's finally told about the opportunity to flee, he goes to his son-in-laws, who just laugh at him. He's the object of mockery. And then after that, this moment that demands urgency is met by Lot's delay, his intransigence, his slowness to act. And finally, even after they grab him by the arm and they drag him out of the city, they've done an extraordinary thing. I mean, what they were doing at the door there, who knows how you could describe how they managed to blind all those men. Lot's experienced the power of God, and yet at that moment in the plain, they're told to flee to the mountain, and what does Lot say? He says, I can't do it. A moment of unbelief, even then having experienced the Lord's deliverance. See, Lot is not the hero we're looking for. He's not the righteous one that might have filled in Abraham's paradigm, his equation. But Lot is important because in his four failings in our story, Lot reminds us of ourselves at moments and our own weaknesses. We're reminded that there are times when we too are slow to act, when we too are unbelieving, when we too have moments to choose rightly and we choose wrongly, when we forget our priorities. Lot reminds us that the righteousness that God calls for is an exceedingly high bar. And at one point, we all come underneath it. In the 1990s, there was a South African cricket captain called Hanzi Cronier. Most people here wouldn't have heard of him, but he was a Christian guy. And actually, he came to Australia a couple of times to tour, and he was overtly Christian. He really spoke a lot about his Christian faith. And churches lined up to get him in to do their men's events, right? He'd get your friends along for dinner, and Hansi would speak about his faith. And then all of a sudden, he had this extraordinary fall from grace. He is convicted of match fixing, is banned for life from playing international cricket, and finally, just the real valley of his fall was him dying in a tragic plane crash. People are devastated at this moment. Christians really devastated. But why? Because he just reminds us that we have the capacity to be heroic and completely stupid within a breath. That on one moment we can do something that's just so fantastic, and in another we can do something that's evil, that's selfish. And to this extent, Lot is a mirror to our own souls. At one moment he's doing something extraordinary, and the next moment he's doing something horrendous. And at times of crisis, we ourselves see these cracks in our own soul, in our own heart. But you know what's so extraordinary about the story of Sodom and the story of Lot? That despite all these failings, Lot is saved. Lot is saved in this story. And if you ended the account at verse 28, it would seem that Lot was saved because at least he was hospitable. At least he welcomed in the strangers and cared for them. But it's interesting, the writer of Genesis doesn't finish the story there. It takes it on to verse 29. And in verse 29, we find the key to understanding the basis of God's salvation. We find the answer to that question that was probed right at the start. On what basis do you save, Lord? The answer is God chooses to save because he remembers. Because he remembers. And he remembers not Abraham's righteousness, but his promise to Abraham. It can't be Abraham's righteousness. The reason is two chapters before this story, we've read about how Abraham slept with his slave girl, Hagar, because he didn't believe that the Lord could provide a child through his old wife, Sarah. And in two chapters' time after this story, Abraham will give his wife over to a pagan king to protect himself. Abraham will do the thing that Lot tried to do but couldn't. It can't be on the basis of Abraham's righteousness that God is saving Lot at this moment. No, God is saving Lot because he promised Abraham in Genesis 12, because he promised Abraham in Genesis 15, because he promised Abraham in Genesis 17, and because again he's remembered the promise he made to Abraham in Genesis 18. It's those promises, you see. It's God's commitment to his word, to his people, which drives him on to save and make a nation for himself. It's his commitment to his promises. That's why God saves Lot at this moment. And this is an important reality to grasp, because this lies actually at the heart of the whole of the Genesis story, that God is committed to his promises, that he is faithful, that the things he said in Genesis 12, he does not forget in generations to come. And he will come through over and over again because he's committed to those fundamental promises to make a nation, to be a blessing to the nations, and to give them a land. And of course, all these moments of promise keeping in Genesis are just shadows. They're just pointers to the ultimate moment of promise keeping that God gives us in the gospel. Because in Jesus, we find the yes to every one of God's promises. You see, in Jesus, we find all those moments, all those hints, all those claims that the Lord makes for blessing and for a future and for a people, we find them fulfilled in the Lord Jesus. God is committed to save and make a people. And so he sends Jesus, who did not come to abolish that law or the prophets, but to fulfill them, of whom all the patriarchs and prophets longed to see. And it is Jesus who steps in and takes our place in the condemned city. It's Jesus who bears the wrath of the fiery wrath of God as it bears down on the cross, instead of us bearing it. These promise-keeping moments in Genesis remind us of the fullness of God's faithfulness showed to us in the gospel, where everything God said he would do for his people, he finally brings together. And so the question for us as we finish is, how will you respond to a God who's consistently, year after year, generation after generation, fulfilling his promises that he makes? How will you respond? In moments of boasting, will you check yourself and remember why you are saved, why you are one of God's people? And in moments of uncertainty, when you doubt whether the Lord will come through for you, will you find your assurance in his faithfulness to his promises? Will you give up your plan Bs and embrace the plan of God? Amen.